Miksi kohtua, paikkaa, josta me kaikki tulemme, on tutkittu niin vähän? Miksi tähän elimeen on heijastettu historian saatossa aina aikansa sosiaalisia normeja? Entä millaisia poliittisia merkityksiä kohtu saa nykyajassa? Näihin kysymyksiin vastaa Lia Hazardin kirja Kohtu, sieltä me kaikki tulemme. Tämä on Kirjalliset ystävät ja minä olen toimittaja Jonna Tapanainen. Lia Hazard on skotlantilainen kätilö, jonka vuonna 2019 ilmestynyt muistelma Hard Pushed keräsi laajalti kiitosta. Uudessa tietoteoksessaan hän käsittelee ihmiskehon ihmeellistä elintä, kenties ihmeellisintä, eli kohtua. Hazardin ydinväite on, että kohtu on historian saatossa ollut hyvin väärin ymmärretty ihmiskehon osa, mutta joka liittyy erottamattomasti meidän biologisiin, sosiaalisiin ja poliittisiin kohtaloihimme. Tämä teos on suoraan sanottuna aika ällistyttävä tietopaketti. Hazard esittelee kohdun rakenteen, elinkaaren, sen kyvyn tuottaa valtavaa onnea, mutta myös suurta tuskaa. Mutta hän näyttää myös, miten kohtuun ei ole koskaan suhtauduttu neutraalisti, vaan siihen on aina liitetty vallitsevia sosiaalisia normeja. Jos kohtu ei esimerkiksi toimi toivotulla tavalla, naisen käytöksessä lienee vika. Toisaalta kohtua on myös usein syytetty kantajansa mielenterveyden häiriöistä. Kohtu on yhdistelmä Hazardin omia kokemuksia kätilönä, historiallista kirjallisuutta, nykytutkimusta sekä lukuisia haastatteluja tavallisten ihmisten, kohtua tutkivien tai kohdullisten paremman kohtelun puolesta taistelevien kanssa. Lia Hazard, it's great to have you as our guest in our podcast.
Great, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your new book, Womb, The Inside Story of Where We All Began, came out this year. Could you first tell our listeners, where do we meet you now? And what is going on with your life right now?
Okay, well, you meet me in the exact spot where I wrote most of the book, which is a desk underneath my older daughter's bunk bed in her room. The book was written mainly between 2020 and sort of mid to late 2022, which obviously was the chunk of time when we were experiencing the pandemic at its worst, and there were rolling lockdowns. And so for most of the time when I was writing the book, I was at home with my children, and I just had to write wherever I could find a space. So this is where it happened, and this is where I continue to write. And in terms of my general life, very busy at the moment. I'm still working clinically as a midwife, and also very lucky and privileged to be promoting the book as it is published across Europe.
Well, there has been a small but welcomed stream of books and articles on how Western medical establishment has overlooked women's bodies and disregarded women's pain. What made you want to write a book about the womb?
Well, it was an idea that was kind of brewing for a while. My last book was a memoir called Hard Pushed, and it was a sort of story of my life in midwifery and generally a celebration of midwives as we are and what we do. And I knew after that book was published that I wanted to continue to write about women's bodies, women's health and reproductive justice more broadly around the world. But it took me a while to kind of find a way into that. And I was actually sitting at this desk one day and kind of mulling this over in my mind. And it just came to me that no one has written a book, a sort of popular, accessible book about the womb, and that the womb itself is not just physiologically interesting, but it is a lens through which we can look at reproductive health and reproductive justice as a whole. So once I started thinking about that, it almost seemed unbelievable that nobody had done this yet so far. And luckily, my agent agreed with me, and so did the publishers who purchased the book. So I hope, has turned out to be a really interesting way of looking at our bodies and how we manage them and medicate them and legislate them in modern society.
Well, your book is truly mind-blowing with the information you provide the reader about the womb, which is an amazingly under-researched organ, considering that it truly is the place where we all began. Your book is wonderfully enlightening and thoroughly researched, and you combine medical history, modern research, you interview people with womb and people who study it or people who fight for better treatment of every womb-related ailment. What was the most rewarding part of writing this book?
I mean, I'm a bit of a geek for all of this kind of stuff. So, you know, it was, again, a real privilege to be able to indulge my passion and my interest. And I would spend many hours on some days going down little internet rabbit holes and scrolling through old documents. And that was always a real joy when I could find something from the past that seemed to illuminate the subject matter. Like, for example, there was a very old sort of treatise written by an English midwife called Percival Willoughby, I think in the 1500s. And I managed to find a sort of scanned copy of it online and read the whole thing and actually read this midwife's words about the case of a local woman who had performed her own hysterectomy. And when you find things from the past that relate to your own modern experience, it really brings the subject matter alive. And the other kind of end of that spectrum was really speaking to people who are here now, who can share their experiences with us now. And that was really so rewarding, and probably especially so because we were in lockdown for so much of this time, you know, to be able to have conversations, some in person, but many also on Zoom, with people who shared their lived experience with me, and also researchers and scientists who are doing such dynamic work. So that was hugely satisfying as well. And I was really excited to bring those stories to the reader.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. According to you, the womb is the most miraculous and misunderstood organ in the human body. It's miraculous, of course, in its ability to produce human life. But after reading this book, one understands many other ways it is truly an impressive organ. Was there some preconception of your own about the womb that changed the most?
Yeah, I mean, the whole writing process was actually full of surprises for me. And it's a funny thing, you know, because obviously, if you're writing a nonfiction book about any subject, you have to position yourself as an expert in that subject, right? So I had to kind of convince the world that I was the womb lady that knew a lot about the womb. And I like to think that I probably did know a bit more about reproductive health than just your average reader. But I would say that at least 80% of what I write about in the book was a complete surprise to me. Maybe not necessarily so much regarding pregnancy and birth, but for example, what I found out about menstruation and periods was completely mind-blowing to me. The fact that menstrual tissue can be so incredibly valuable, that each person's menstrual tissue has its own biochemical fingerprint, and that we can use this tissue and this blood potentially even to diagnose and treat diseases in the future. And this to me is a really transformative area of reproductive health that I was excited to bring to the reader. And further on in the book, when I was writing more generally about reproductive justice and legislation around the world, I learned so much about the history of forced sterilization as a means of reproductive oppression, learned so much about abortion legislation around the world, which is of course really topical. So a lot of this was new to me, and it was really important to me that I was able to convey that excitement and fascination to the reader as well, so I could take the reader on that journey with me.
Well, it was sometimes very frustrating and even angering to read how medical science has never treated the womb neutrally, as just one part of human body. How do we still see this in our lives?
Well, I mean, I think you only have to open any newspaper nowadays to see that everybody has an opinion about the womb, you know, such as what should or shouldn't happen inside it, how it should be managed, how it should be treated. But very few people actually know anything about it, you know, and we see this in, you know, contemporary issues, not just about abortion and reproductive rights, but also about menopause and hormone replacement therapy and things like menstrual leave and how endometriosis is treated and menstrual disorders, heavy bleeding and pain. You know, these topics make the news on a regular basis, but the people who speak most loudly about them seem to know the least. And that to me is actually a tragedy and a huge injustice to people with wombs who have to not just function in the world, but hopefully thrive in the world as well.
Yeah. The common idea of the womb has been that it's a sterile, passive container, an organ that has only one job. But far from it, like you write, the womb can contain a lot of important information of the body. First of all, there's rich microbial life that has been overlooked, even though that bacteria may hold very important information about, for example, infertility or disease. It is kind of staggering that the science has overlooked this information so long.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I'm glad you brought up the uterine microbiome and this field of science, because again, this was very new to me, and it was staggering to me that I didn't know about it, and it's not being, more publicized and more funded. I think for many, many years, when scientists and doctors have thought about reproductive and gynecological health, it's just in terms of penis goes in and baby comes out, right? So it's like, can this person have sex and accommodate a male penetrative partner? And can this person create and eject a baby? But we know now that the uterus and the reproductive tract in general are doing so much more than just sex and birth. So when it comes to, for example, the microbiome, scientists thought for many, many years, and I even was led to believe as well, that the uterus itself is a sterile environment, that unless there is a fetus growing inside the uterus, it's essentially empty, it's blank, it's inert. But what scientists have begun to understand over the last 10, 20 years, now that analysis techniques have become more advanced, is that the uterus itself, as far as we can tell, very likely has its own microbiome. So it's teeming with billions of microorganisms, from bacteria to fungi to, you know, other microorganisms, and that each person's uterine microbiome can probably tell us a lot about their health state as well. Now, we know we're very used to thinking about the gut microbiome and how the gut microbiome affects our immune system and possibly even our mental health. But to think that the uterus itself has its own microbiome opens up a whole new area of research that, again, potentially is transformative for gynecological health. So I was, again, really excited to bring this idea to readers.
Yeah. Well, and second of all, it was surprising to read that womb is very active, because it is not a passive organ waiting for the insemination by the competitive sperm, but takes part in many ways.
Yeah, for sure. And again, you know, new to me in many ways was the concept that the uterus, in terms of sex and conception, is not just this passive, inert thing. You know, we're led to believe that the egg just lies there waiting for this heroic questing sperm to make its way through the treacherous vagina, and you know that the sperm is doing all the work here. But what we know is actually the cervix, which is the neck of the womb, has little pockets or crypts in it that can store sperm and then release them when it's the most optimal time for fertilization. And in terms of the uterine lining itself, the lining of the womb has what we call peristalsis, which is like tiny wave-like motions that can encourage the sperm to be redrawn further into the reproductive tract, again, to facilitate conception. So, you know, when you look at all of these mechanisms as a whole, we realize that actually the uterus and the reproductive tract are playing a really, really active role in creating new life and facilitating conception. It's not just, you know, the man and the male sperm that's doing all the important work here. And again, you know, this plays into the whole idea that women or people with wombs are just these passive vessels that are waiting to be fertilized, and that we have no intrinsic value of our own, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah. Well, as we are in the middle of the culture wars, especially about gender and who gets to be a woman, I loved how inclusive you are in your book. The womb is neither necessary nor sufficient to define a woman. It is not an essential core of some mystical womanhood. It is an organ that some cis women don't even have. It is an organ that trans men maybe want to get rid of. Or it's an organ trans women might be able to have near future as organ transplant. What are your thoughts on this, womb being such a political battlefield?
Well, it's really frustrating, and I knew when I began to write the book that I would make certain people very angry. And you learn very quickly as an author that you just can't please everyone all the time. So you have to make certain decisions about what your values really are and what your truth really is. And I established pretty early on with this book that I did want to be as inclusive as possible, not only because, you know, in my work as a midwife, I try to be inclusive and compassionate and open-minded, and I like to continue that attitude as an author, but also because it's factual, you know, it's just science, it's just truth that not all women have a uterus and not all people who have a uterus are women. And we can argue all day long about gender and, you know, trans issues and contemporary debates around that. But the fact of the matter is that if you're talking about this organ, yes, it overlaps with sex and gender, but not exclusively. You know, the Venn diagram for that is pretty complex. It's pretty muddy. So as you've mentioned, I wanted to set that straight right at the start of the book. And it was really important to me that I included stories of, men and women and their relationships with the womb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also write about hysterectomy, which along with forced abortions, sterilizations, have been a tool of mass oppression. This is of course especially true of women who have been marginalized. Black and brown women, enslaved, incarcerated or detained women. Unfortunately, these are not a thing of the past still.
It's absolutely not a thing of the past. And what I researched during the course of the book was that, for example, in California, in America, still there's legislation going through the state chambers about reparations for previously incarcerated people who suffered forced and coercive sterilization at the hands of doctors appointed by the state. And also, I spoke to a human rights lawyer who was doing work with migrants who were detained at a center in America, where they were sent to a local doctor who, again, was performing sterilizations and different gynecological procedures without these women's consent. So absolutely, this is still a very ever-present issue. And we know that rape and sexual violence, which includes forced sterilization, have been weapons of war for as long as, you know, history can record, and unfortunately will continue to be so. This issue is very alive, and it's important for readers to recognize that.
Mm. You also write about that after all these anti-abortion laws in the United States, but also in Europe, women's health and lives are even more in danger.
This is an issue about which I'm very passionate, as you can imagine, you know, and it goes back to what I was saying about, you know, the people who shout the loudest about women's wombs actually understand the very least about them. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we see almost every day stories coming out of states in America where they have these very restrictive abortion laws now, where abortion cannot be performed unless the woman's life is immediately threatened, as in, you know, she's close to death if this procedure is not performed. So we're hearing these stories of women who sadly may have already, their baby's heart has stopped beating, so they've had what's essentially a missed miscarriage. But instead of performing a termination, the doctors now have to wait until these women become incredibly septic and very, very sick, which is cruel and inhumane and just goes against every principle of good medicine. But we will see more and more of this happening precisely because these laws are being made by people who, in my opinion, hate women and also, more objectively, just don't understand anything about reproductive health. And it's incredibly dangerous. And I hope that my anger about this jumps off the page. I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
Even though the book made me sad and angry in many ways, it made me also hopeful since you interview so many people who are fighting for a better treatment and more thorough research of every womb-related issue. In the future, people with womb have a better say in their care also. How do you feel about the future? In regards of these anti-abortion laws, but also thinking about the research that is taking huge leaps forward.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, sometimes I feel cautiously optimistic and then sometimes something will come up in the news or whatever and I feel incredibly sad and depressed about it. I think in some ways, reproductive health and certainly reproductive justice are moving backwards. But in other ways, as you said, there are great leaps and bounds in science and new medical technologies and innovations. And I think, you know, I spoke to fantastic researchers for the book doing amazing work in all kinds of new frontiers. And I think maybe their work won't improve things for my generation, but possibly it will filter down to my daughter's generation. You know, I have two girls who are 16 and 20. They're young women. Most of their gynecological lives are still ahead of them. And I like to think that maybe in the fullness of time, things will be better for them. I certainly think their generation is better at talking about these things openly. I think social media has been really good for that. So hopefully that awareness combined with scientific advances will generate some kind of positive change in the future.
Well, I'm glad there is so much information now available and your book as well. And I, on the other hand, have two sons, and I would hope that they would read your book in the future, and men in general would read your book. Have you had male readers, and if so, what has the feedback been like?
You know, it's interesting. I've had, to my knowledge, very few male readers, but the feedback I've had from them has been positive. I think they've learned a lot, which is great. That's the goal. And it's interesting that you say you have two sons and you would like them to read the book as well, because that would be fantastic. And actually, my sister-in-law is Finnish. She's another hazard in Helsinki. And she has two sons. And what I've found is that Finnish culture seems to be much more equitable in terms of men understanding sexual and reproductive health and just generally being more open about that kind of thing. I don't know if you know if you feel that's the case, but certainly from the outside, that's how things look to me. So yeah, I definitely hope that men and, you know, even young men all around the world will have a look at this book. Maybe if it's lying on their mum's or their girlfriend's bedside table, I would hope that they would have a look through it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is also very interesting, the topic of transplanted or artificial wombs in the future. That could mean that many more dreams about having a child or a family will come true for same-sex couples, single parents, for women who can't have babies, and trans women. Seems kind of a beautiful future.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think any time that there's a big new development in reproductive health, it evokes very strong reactions on both sides. So if you look at the example of artificial wombs or what some people call ectogenesis, which just means, you know, gestation outside of the body, some people think this is repulsive and it's kind of against the natural order of things and it's very harsh and clinical and sterile. And I can understand that viewpoint, and other people look at it more positively and think about how it might facilitate parenthood in different ways for people who maybe wouldn't have otherwise had children. I spoke to a medical ethical legal researcher for the book who pointed out that possibly these synthetic wombs could be used as a tool of capitalism. You know, women would be encouraged to outsource their gestation so they can work harder. So it's really interesting. I don't know exactly what the answer is. I think maybe the answer is just we have to proceed with caution. You know, there was similar kind of backlash when IVF first became available. And now we think of it as almost commonplace. So we just have to be very careful and responsible with how we introduce any innovation in this field.
Tämä oli Kirjalliset ystävät. Tässä jaksossa keskustelimme siis Lia Hazardin kanssa hänen uudesta kirjastaan Kohtu, sieltä me kaikki tulemme. Kirjan on suomentanut Niina Mäki-Kihniä.